fast. He did not answer. The Grand Inquisitor tilted his head ever so slightly to the left, and Father Farrell waved two fingers over one of the console icons. The icons were as abstract as hieroglyphics to the untutored eye, but Farrell knew them well. The one he had chosen would have translated as crushed testicles. On the gurney, Corporal Key gasped and opened his mouth to scream, but the neural inhibitors blocked that reaction. The short man's jaws opened as wide as they could, and Father Farrell could hear the muscles and tendons stretching. The Grand Inquisitor nodded, and Farrell removed his fingers from the activation zone above the icon. Corporal Key's entire body convulsed on the gurney, his stomach muscles rippling in tension. "It's only virtual pain, Corporal Key," whispered the Grand Inquisitor. "A neural illusion. Your body is not marked." On the slab, Key was straining to raise his head to look down at his body, but the stick-tight band held his head in place. "Or perhaps not," continued the Cardinal. "Perhaps this time we have resorted to older, less refined methods." He took a step closer to the gurney so that the man could see his face. "Again, why did you and Father Captain de Soya let the girl go on God's Grove? Why did you attack your crewmate, Radamanth Nemes?" Corporal Key's mouth worked until his back teeth became visible.
"Fuck you,"
he managed, his jaws tight against the shaking that was racking him. "Of course," said the Grand Inquisitor, and nodded to Father Farrell. This time the icon Farrell activated could be translated as "hot wire behind the right eye." Corporal Key opened his mouth in a silent scream. "Again," said the Grand Inquisitor softly. "Tell us."
"Excuse me, Your Eminence," said Father Farrell, glancing at his comm log. "But the conclave mass begins in 45 minutes.
The Grand Inquisitor waved his fingers.
"We have time, Martin, we have time."
He touched Corporal Key's upper arm.
"Tell us these few facts, Corporal, and you will be bathed, dressed, and released. You have sinned against your church and your Lord by this betrayal, but the essence of the church is forgiveness. Explain your betrayal, and all will be forgiven."
Amazingly, muscles still rippling with shock, Corporal Key laughed.
"Fuck you," he said. "You've already made me tell you everything I know under truth-tell. You know why we killed that bitch thing and let the child go, and you'll never let me go. Fuck you."
The Grand Inquisitor shrugged and stepped back. Glancing at his own gold comm log, he said softly,
"We have time. Much time."
He nodded to Father Farrell. The icon that looked like a double parenthesis on the virtual pain console stood for "broad and heated blade down esophagus." With a graceful motion of his eyes, Father Farrell activated it. Father Captain Federico de Soya was returned to life on Pochum, and had spent 2 weeks as a de facto prisoner in the Vatican rectory of the Legionaries of Christ. The refectory was comfortable and tranquil. The plump little resurrection chaplain who attended to his needs, Father Baggio, was as kindly and solicitous as ever. De Soya hated the place and the priest. No one told Father Captain de Soya that he could not leave the Legionaries' rectory, but he was made to understand that he should stay there until called. After a week of gaining strength and orientation after his resurrection, he was called to Paxfleet headquarters, where he met with Admiral Wu and her boss, Admiral Marusin. Father Captain de Soya did little during the meeting except salute, stand at ease, and listen. Admiral Marusin explained that a review of the Father Captain de Soya's court-martial of 4 years earlier had shown several irregularities and inconsistencies in the prosecution's case. Further review of the situation had warranted a reversal of the court-martial board's decision.
Father Captain de Soya was to be reinstated immediately at his former rank of captain in Pax Fleet. Arrangements were being made to find him a ship for combat duty.
"Your old tortship, the Balthazar, is in dry dock for a year," said Admiral Marusin. "A complete refitting, being brought up to Archangel Escort standards. Your replacement, Mother Captain Stone, did an excellent job as skipper."
"Yes, sir," said de Soya. "Stone was an excellent exec. I'm sure she's been a good boss." Admiral Marusin nodded absently as he thumbed through vellum sheets in his notebook.
"Yes, yes," he said. "So good, in fact, that we've recommended her as skipper for one of the new planet-class archangels. We have an archangel in mind for you as well, Father Captain."
De Soya blinked and tried not to react. "The Raphael, sir?" The Admiral looked up, his tanned and creased face set in a slight smile.
"Yes, the Raphael, but not the one you skippered before. We've retired that prototype to courier duty and renamed her. The new Archangel Raphael is... Well, you've heard about the planet-class Archangels, Father Captain?"
"No, sir, not really." He had heard rumors on his desert world when bauxite miners had talked loudly in the one cantina in town.
"Four standard years," muttered the Admiral, shaking his head. His white hair was combed back behind his ears. "Bring Federico up to speed here, Admiral."
Margaret Wu nodded and touched the disk key on a standard tactical console set into Admiral Marusin's wall. A hollow of a starship came into existence between her and de Soya. The father captain could see at once that this ship was larger, sleeker, more refined, and deadlier than his old Raphael. "His Holiness has asked each industrial world in the Pax to build, or at least to bankroll, one of these planet-class Archangel battlecruisers, Father Captain," said Admiral Wu in her briefing voice. "In the past 4 years, 21 of them have been completed and have entered active service. Another 60 are nearing completion." The hollow began to rotate and enlarge until suddenly the main deck was shown in cutaway. It was as if a laser lance had sliced the ship in half. "As you see," continued Wu, "the living areas, common decks, and C-3 tactical centers are much roomier than on the earlier Raphael, roomier even than your old tortship. The drives, both the classified C-plus instantaneous Gideon drive and the in-system fusion plant, have been reduced in size by 1/3 while gaining in efficiency and ease of maintenance. The new Raphael carries 3 atmospheric dropships and a high-speed scout. There are automated resurrection creches aboard to serve a crew of 28 and up to 22 marines or passengers." "Defenses?" asked Father Captain de Soya, still standing at ease, his hands clasped behind him. "Class 10 containment fields," said Wu crisply. "The newest stealth technology. Omega-class ECM and jamming ability, as well as the usual assortment of close-in hyperkinetic and energy defenses." "Attack capabilities?" said de Soya. He could tell from the apertures and arrays visible on the hollow, but he wanted to hear it. Admiral Marusin answered with a tone of pride, as if showing off a new grandchild.
"The whole 9 meters, he said. CPBs, of course, but feeding off the C-plus drive core rather than the fusion drive. Slag anything within half an AU. New Hawking hyperkinetic missiles, miniaturized, about half the mass and size of the ones you carried on Balthazar. Plasma needles with almost twice the yield of the warheads of 5 years ago. Death beams." Father Captain de Soya tried not to react. Death beams had been prohibited in Pax Fleet. Marusin saw something in the other man's face.
"Things have changed, Federico. This fight is to the finish. The ousters are breeding like fruit flies out there in the dark, and unless we stop them, they'll be slagging Pacham in a year or two."
Father Captain de Soya nodded. "Do you mind if I ask which world paid for the building of this new Raphael, sir?" Marusin smiled and gestured toward the hollow. The hull of the ship seemed to hurtle toward de Soya as the magnification increased. The view cut through the hull and closed on the tactical bridge, moving to the edge of the tactical center hollow pit, until the father captain could make out a small bronze plaque with the name HHS Raphael, and beneath that, in smaller script, "Built and commissioned by the people of Heaven's Gate for the defense of all humanity."
"Why are you smiling, Father Captain?"
asked Admiral Marusin. "Well, sir, it's just... well, I've been to the world of Heaven's Gate, sir. It was, of course, more than 4 standard years ago, but the planet was empty, except for a dozen or so prospectors and a Pax garrison in orbit. There's been no real population there since the Alster invasion 300 years ago, sir. I just couldn't imagine that world financing one of these ships. It seems to me that it would take a planetary GNP of a society like Renaissance Vectors to pay for a single Archangel." Marusin's smile had not faltered.
"Precisely, Father Captain. Heaven's Gate is a hellhole. Poison atmosphere, acid rain, endless mud and sulfur flats. It's never recovered from the Alster attack. But His Holiness thought that the Pax's stewardship of that world might be better transferred to private enterprise. The planet still holds a fortune in heavy metals and chemicals. So we have sold it."
This time DeSoya blinked. "Sold it, sir? An entire world?" While Marusin openly grinned, Admiral Wu said, "To the Opus Dei, Father Captain." DeSoya did not speak, but neither did he show comprehension. "The Work of God used to be a minor religious organization," said Wu. "It's, I believe, about 1,200 years old, founded in 1920 A.D. In the past few years, it has become not only a great ally of the Holy See, but a worthy competitor of the Pax Mercantilis." "Ah, yes," said Father Captain DeSoya. He could imagine the Mercantilis buying up entire worlds, but he could not imagine the trading group allowing a rival to gain such power in the few years he had been out of Pax news. It did not matter. He turned to Admiral Marusin. "One last question, sir." The Admiral glanced at his comlog chronometer and nodded curtly. "I have been out of fleet service for 4 years," DeSoya said softly. "I have not worn a uniform or received a tech update in all that time. The world where I served as a priest was so far out of the mainstream that I might as well have been in cryogenic fugue the whole time. How could I possibly take command of a new generation Archangel-class starship, sir?" Marusin frowned.
"We'll bring you up to speed, Father Captain. Pax Fleet knows what it's doing. Are you saying no to this commission?"
Father Captain DeSoya hesitated a visible second. "No, sir," he said. "I appreciate the confidence in me that you and Pax Fleet are showing. I'll do my best, Admiral." DeSoya had been trained to discipline twice, once as a priest and Jesuit, again as an officer in His Holiness's fleet. Marusin's stone face softened.
"Of course you will, Federico. We're pleased to have you back. We'd like you to stay at the Legionary's rectory here on Pacem until we're ready to send you to your ship, if that would be all right."
"Damn it," thought DeSoya. "Still a prisoner with those damned legionaries." He said, "Of course, sir, it's a pleasant place." Marusin glanced at his comlog again. The interview was obviously at an end.
"Any requests before the assignment becomes official, Father Captain?"
DeSoya hesitated again. He knew that making a request would be bad form. He spoke anyway. "Yes, sir, one. There were 3 men who served with me on the old Raphael, Swiss Guard commandos whom I brought from Hyperion. Lancer Reddick, well, he died, sir. But Sergeant Gregorius and Corporal Key were with me until the end, and I wondered..." Marusin nodded impatiently.
"You want them on new Raphael with you? It sounds reasonable. I used to have a cook that I dragged from ship to ship. Poor bugger was killed during the second coal sack engagement. I don't know about these men."
The Admiral looked at Margit Wu. "By great coincidence," said Admiral Wu, "I ran across their files while reviewing your reinstatement papers, Father Captain. Sergeant Gregorius is currently serving in the Ring Territories. I am sure that a transfer can be arranged. Corporal Key, I am afraid..." DeSoya's stomach muscles tightened. Key had been with him around God's Grove. Gregorius had been returned to the creche after an unsuccessful resurrection. and the last he had seen of the lively little corporal had been after their return to Potsdam Space, when the MPs had taken them away to separate holding cells after their arrest. DeSoya had shaken the corporal's hand and assured him that they would see each other again. "I am afraid that Corporal Key died 2 standard years ago," finished Wu. "He was killed during an ouster attack on the Sagittarius salient. I understand that he received the Silver Star of St. Michael's. Posthumously, of course." DeSoya nodded tersely. "Thank you," he said. Admiral Maruyasin gave his paternal politician smile and extended his hand across the desk to DeSoya.
"Good luck, Federico. Give them hell from the Raphael."
The headquarters for the Pax Mercantilis was not on Potsdam proper, but was located, fittingly, on the L5 Trojan point trailing behind the planet by some 60 orbital degrees. Between the Vatican World and the huge, hollow Taurus Mercantilis, a carbon-carbon donut 270 meters thick, a full click wide, and 26 kilometers in diameter, its interior webbed with spidery dry docks, comm antennae, and loading bays, floated half of Pax Fleet's total orbital-based firepower. Kenzo Isozaki once calculated that a coup attempt launched from Taurus Mercantilis would last 12.06 nanoseconds before being vaporized. Isozaki's office was in a clear bulb on a whiskered carbon flower stem, raised some 400 meters above the outer rim of the Taurus. The bulb's curved hull skin could be opaqued or left transparent, according to the whim of the CEO inside it. Today it was transparent except for the section polarized to dim the glare of Potsdam's yellow sun. Space seemed black at the moment, but as the Taurus rotated, the bulb would come into the ring's shadow, and Isozaki could glance up to see stars instantly appear, as if a heavy black curtain had been pulled aside to reveal thousands of brilliant, unflickering candles. "Or the myriad campfires of my enemies," thought Isozaki, as the darkness fell for the 20th time on this working day. With the walls absolutely transparent, his oval office with its modest desk, chairs, and soft lamps seemed to become a carpeted platform, standing alone in the immensity of space, individual stars blazing and the long swath of the Milky Way lighting the interior. But it was not this familiar spectacle that made the Mercantilis CEO look up. Set amid the star field, 3 fusion tails of incoming freighters could be picked out, looking like smudges on an astronomical hollow. Isozaki was so adept at gauging distances and delta Vs from fusion tails that he could tell at a glance how long it would be before these freighters docked, and even which ships they were. The PM Moldahar Effectuator had refueled by skimming a gas giant in the Epsilon Eridani system and was burning redder than usual. The HHMS Emma Constance Skipper was in her usual rush to get her cargo of Pegasus 51 reaction metals to the Taurus, and was decelerating inbound a good 15% above Mercantilis recommendations. Finally, the smallest smudge could only be the HHMS Eleemosynaria Apostolica, just passing spin down from its C-plus translation point from Renaissance System. Isozaki knew this from a glance, just as he knew the 300-some other optimal translation points visible in his part of the Potsdam system sky. The lift tube rose from the floor and became a transparent cylinder, its passenger lit by starlight. Isozaki knew that the cylinder was transparent only from the outside. In it, the occupants stood in a mirrored interior, seeing nothing of the CEO's office, staring at their own reflection, until Isozaki keyed their door open. Anna Pelli Cognani was the only person in the tube. Isozaki nodded, and his personal AI rotated the cube door open. His fellow CEO and protege did not even glance up at the moving starfield as she crossed the carpet toward him.
"Good afternoon, Kenzo-san."
"Good afternoon, Anna."
He waved her toward the most comfortable chair, but Konyani shook her head and remained standing. She never took a seat in Isozaki's office. Isozaki never ceased offering her one.
"The conclave mass is almost over," said Konyani.
Isozaki nodded. At that second, his office AI darkened the bubble walls and projected the Vatican's tight-beam broadcast. St. Peter's Basilica was awash in scarlet and purple and black and white this morning, as the 83 cardinals, soon to be sealed in the conclave, bowed, prayed, genuflected, knelt, stood, and sang. Behind this terna, or herd of theoretically possible candidates for the papacy, were the hundreds of bishops and archbishops, deacons and members of the Curia, Pax military officials and Pax civil administrators, Pax planetary governors and high elected officials who happened to be on Pacem at the time of the Pope's death, or who were within 3 weeks' time debt, delegates from the Dominicans, the Jesuits, the Benedictines, the Legionaries of Christ, the Mariaists, the Salesians, and a single delegate standing for the few remaining Franciscans. Finally, there were the valued guests in the back rows, honorary delegates from the Pax Mercantilis, the Opus Dei, the Instituto per Opere di Religione, also known as the Vatican Bank, delegates from the Vatican administrative wings of the Prefettura, the Servizio Assistenziale del Santo Padre, the Holy Father's Welfare Service, from the APSA, the administration of the patrimony of the Holy See, as well as from Cardinal Camerlengo's own apostolic chamber. Also in the rear pews were honored guests from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, the Papal Commission on Interstellar Peace and Justice, many papal academies, such as the Pontifical Ecclesiastical Academy, and other quasi-theological organizations necessary to the running of the vast Pax State. Finally, there were the bright uniforms of the Corps Helvetica, the Swiss Guard, as well as commanders of the Palatine Guard, reconstituted by Pope Julius, and the first appearance of the commander of the hitherto secret Noble Guard, a pale, dark-haired man in a solid red uniform. Isozaki and Konyani watched this pageant with knowledgeable eyes. Each of them had been invited to the Mass, but it had become a tradition in recent centuries for the Pax Mercantilis CEOs to honor major church ceremonies by their absence, sending only their official Vatican delegates. Both watched Cardinal Quesnongle celebrate this Mass of the Holy Spirit, and saw Cardinal Camerlengo as the powerless figurehead he was. Their eyes were on Cardinal Lourdesami, Cardinal Mustafa, and half a dozen other power brokers in the front pews. With the final benediction, the Mass ended, and the voting cardinals filed out in solemn procession to the Sistine Chapel, where the holocams lingered while the doors were sealed. The entrance to the conclave was closed, and that door bolted on the inside and padlocked on the outside, and the sealing of the conclave pronounced official by the commandant of the Swiss Guards and the prefect of the pontifical household. The Vatican coverage then shifted to commentary and speculation, while the image remained of the sealed door. "Enough," said Kenzo Isozaki. The broadcast flashed off, the bubble grew transparent, and sunlight flooded the room under a black sky. Anna Pelikonyani smiled thinly.
"The voting shouldn't take too long."
Isozaki had returned to his chair. Now he steepled his fingers and tapped his lower lip. "Anna," he said, "do you think that we, all of us in the chairmanship of the Mercantilis, have any real power?" Konyani's neutral expression showed her surprise. She said,
"During the last fiscal year, Kenzo-san, my division showed a profit of 36 billion marks."
Isozaki held his steepled fingers still. "M. Konyani," he said, "would you be so kind as to remove your jacket and shirt?" His protege did not blink. In the 28 standard years they had been colleagues, subordinate and master, actually, M. Isozaki had never done, said, or implied anything that might have been interpreted as a sexual overture. She hesitated only a second, then unsealed her jacket, slipped it off, set it on the chair she never sat in, and unsealed her shirt. She folded it atop her jacket on the back of the chair. Isozaki rose and came around his desk, standing only a meter from her.
"You're under things as well," he said, slipping off his own jacket and unbuttoning his own old-fashioned shirt. His chest was healthy, muscled, but hairless.
Konyani slipped off her chemise. Her breasts were small but perfectly formed, rosy at the tips. Kenzo Isozaki lifted one hand as if he were going to touch her, pointed, and then returned the hand to his own chest and touched the double-barred cruciform that ran from his sternum to just above his navel.
"This," he said, "is power."
He turned away and began dressing. After a moment, Anna Pelli Konyani hugged her shoulders and then also began dressing. When they were both dressed, Isozaki sat behind his desk again and gestured toward the other chair. To his quiet astonishment, M. Anna Pelli Konyani sat in it.
"What you are saying," began Konyani, "is that no matter how successful we are in making ourselves indispensable to the new pope, if there ever is a new pope, the church will always have the ultimate leverage of resurrection."
"Not quite," said Isozaki, steepling his fingers again as if the previous interlude had not happened. "I am saying that the power controlling the cruciform controls the human universe."
"The church," began Konyani and stopped. "Of course, the cruciform is just part of the power equation. The Technocorps provides the church with the secret of successful resurrection. But they've been in league with the church for 280 years.
"For their own purposes," said Isozaki softly. "What are those purposes, Anna?"
The office rotated into night. Stars exploded into existence. Konyani raised her face to the Milky Way to gain a moment to think.
"No one knows," she said at last. "Ohm's Law."
Isozaki smiled.
"Very good. Following the path of least resistance here may not lead us through the church, but via the core."
"But Counselor Albedo meets with no one except His Holiness and Lord Usami."
"No one that we know of," amended Isozaki. "But that is a matter of the core coming to the human universe."
Konyani nodded. She understood the implicit suggestion. The illicit core-class AIs that the Mercantilis was developing could find the datum plane avenue and follow it to the core. For almost 300 years, the prime commandment enforced by the Church and Pax had been, "Thou shalt not build a thinking machine equal or superior to humankind." AIs in use within the Pax were more all-purpose instruments than artificial intelligences of the kind that had evolved away from humanity almost a millennium earlier. Idiot thinking machines like Isosaki's office AI or the cretinous ship computer under Soya's old ship, the Raphael. But in the past dozen years, secret research departments of the Pax Mercantilis had recreated the autonomous AIs equal to or surpassing those in common use during the days of the hegemony. The risk and benefits of this project were almost beyond measure. Absolute domination of Pax trade and a breaking of the old balance of power standoff between Pax Fleet and Pax Mercantilis, if successful. Excommunication, torture in the dungeons of the Holy Office, and execution, if discovered by the Church. And now this prospect. Anna Pelli Konyani stood.
"My God," she said softly, "that would be the ultimate end run."
Isozaki nodded and smiled again.
"Do you know where that term originated, Anna?"
"End run? No. Some sport, I imagine."
"A very ancient warfare surrogate sport called football," said Isozaki.
Konyani knew that this irrelevancy was anything but irrelevant. Sooner or later, her master would explain why this datum was important. She waited.
"The church had something that the Corps wanted, needed," said Isozaki. "The taming of the cruciform was their part of the deal.
the church had to barter something of equal worth.
Cognani thought, equal in worth to the immortality of a trillion human beings?
She said,
I had always assumed that when Lennar Hoyt and Lord Usami contacted the surviving core elements more than 2 centuries ago, that the church's bartering point was in secretly re-establishing the technocore in human space.
Isozaki opened his hands.
To what ends, Anna? Where is the benefit to the core?
When the core was an integral part of the hegemony, she said, running the world web and the fat line, they were using the neurons in the billions of human brains transiting the forecasters as a sort of neural net, part of their ultimate intelligence project.
Ah, yes, said her mentor. But there are no forecasters now. If they are using human beings, how and where?
Without meaning to, Anna Pelli Cognani raised one hand to her breastbone.
Isozaki smiled. Irritating, isn't it? Like a word that is on the tip of one's tongue but will not come to mind. A puzzle with a missing piece. But there is one piece that was missing, which has just been found.
Cognani raised an eyebrow.
The girl?
Back in Pax Space, said the older CEO. Our agents close to Lord Usami have confirmed that the Corps has revealed this. It happened after the death of His Holiness. Only the Secretary of State, the Grand Inquisitor, and the top people in Pax Fleet know.
Where is she?
Isozaki shook his head.
If the Corps knows, they haven't revealed it to the Church or any other human agency. But Pax Fleet has called up that ship's captain, DeSoya, because of the news.
The Corps had predicted that he would be involved in the girl's capture, said Cognani. The beginnings of a smile were working at the corners of her mouth.
Yes, said Isozaki, proud of his student.
Ohm's Law, said Cognani.
Precisely.
The woman stood and again touched her chest without being aware of doing so.
If we find the girl first, we have the leverage to open discussions with the Corps, and the means, with the new abilities we will have online.
None of the CEOs who knew of the secret AI project ever said the words or phrases aloud, despite their bug-proof offices.
If we have the girl and the means of negotiating, continued Cognani, we may have the leverage we need to supplant the Church in the Corps' arrangement with humanity.
If we can discover what the Corps is getting from the Church in return for control of the cruciform, murmured Isozaki, and offer the same or better.
Cognani nodded in a distracted manner. She was seeing how all of this related to her goals and efforts as CEO of Opus Dei. In every way, she realized at once.
In the meantime, we have to find the girl before the others do. Pax Fleet must be utilizing resources they would never reveal to the Vatican.
And vice versa, said Isozaki.
This kind of contest pleased him very much.
And we will have to do the same, said
Cognani, turning toward the lift tube.
Every resource.
She smiled at her mentor.
It's the ultimate three-way, zero-sum game, isn't it, Kenzo-san?
Just so, said Isozaki. Everything to the winner. Power, immortality, and wealth beyond human imagining. To the loser? Destruction, the true death, and eternal slavery for one's descendants.
He held up one finger.
But not a three-way game, Anna. 6.
Cognani paused by the lift door.
I see the 4th, she said. The Corps has its own imperative to find the girl first, but...
Isozaki lowered his hand.
We must presume that the child has her own goals in this game, mustn't we? And whoever or whatever has introduced her as a playing piece, well, that must be our 6th player.
Or one of the other 5, said Cognani, smiling.
She also enjoyed a high-stakes game.
Isozaki nodded and turned his chair to watch the next sunrise above the curving away band of the Taurus Mercantilis. He did not turn back when the lift door closed and Anna Pelli Cognani departed. Above the altar, Jesus Christ, his face stern and unrelenting, divided men into camps of the good and the bad, the rewarded and the damned. There was no third group. Cardinal Lourdesami sat in his canopied stall inside the Sistine Chapel and looked at Michelangelo's fresco of the Last Judgment. Lourdesami had always thought that this Christ was a bullying, authoritarian, merciless figure, perhaps an icon perfectly suited to oversee this choice of a new vicar of Christ. The little chapel was crowded with the 83 canopied stalls seating the 83 cardinals present in the flesh. An empty space allowed for activation of the hollows representing the missing 37 cardinals, one hollow of a canopied stall at a time. This was the first morning after the cardinals had been nailed up in the Vatican Palace. Lourdesami had slept and eaten well, his bedroom a cot in his Vatican office, his repast a simple meal cooked by the nuns of the Vatican guest house. Simple food and a cheap white wine served in the glorious Borgia apartments. Now all were gathered in the Sistine Chapel, their stall thrones in place, their canopies raised. Lourdesami knew that this splendid sight had been missing from the conclave for many centuries, ever since the number of cardinals had grown too large to accommodate the stalls in the small chapel, sometime pre-Hegira, the 19th or 20th century A.D., he thought. But the church had grown so small by the end of the fall of the Farcasters that the 40-some cardinals could once again easily fit. Pope Julius had kept the number small, never more than 120 cardinals, despite the growth of the Pax. And with almost 40 of them unable to travel in time to the conclave, the Sistine Chapel could hold the stalls of those cardinals permanently based on Pacem. The moment had come. All of the cardinal electors in the chapel stood as one. In the empty space near the scrutineer's table near the altar, the hollows of the 37 absent cardinal electors shimmered into existence. Because the space was small, the hollows were small. Little more than doll-sized human figures in doll-sized wooden stalls, all of them floating in midair, like ghosts of conclave electors past. Lourdesami smiled, as he always did, at how appropriate the reduced size of these absent electors seemed. Pope Julius had always been elected by acclamation. One of the three cardinals acting as scrutineers raised his hand. The Holy Spirit may have been prepared to move these men and women, but some coordination was required. When the scrutineer's hand dropped, the 83 cardinals in 37 hollows were to speak as one.
"Eligo Father Lenar Hoyt,"
cried Cardinal Lourdesami, and saw Cardinal Mustafa shouting the same words from beneath the canopy of his stall. The scrutineer in front of the altar paused. The acclamation had been loud and clear, but obviously not unanimous. This was a new wrinkle. For 270 years, the acclamation had been immediate. Lourdesami was careful not to smile or look around. He knew which of the newer cardinals had not cried out Pope Julius's name for re-election. He knew the wealth it had taken to bribe these men and women. He knew the terrible risk they were running and would almost certainly suffer for. Lourdesami knew all this because he had helped to orchestrate it. After a moment of consultation among the scrutineers, the one who had called for acclamation now said,
"We shall proceed by scrutiny."
There was excited talk among the cardinals as the ballots were prepared and handed out. This had never happened before in the lifetime of most of these princes of the church. Immediately, the acclamation hollows of the missing cardinal electors had become irrelevant, although a few of the absent cardinals had prepared their interactive chips for scrutiny, most had not bothered. The master of ceremonies moved among the stalls, distributing voting cards, three to each cardinal elector. The scrutineers moved among the forest of stalls to make sure that each of the cardinals had a pen. When all was in readiness, The cardinal deacon among the scrutineers raised his hand again, this time to signify the moment of voting. Lord Usami looked at his ballot. On the upper left, the words, "Eligo in summum pontificem," appeared in print. There was room for one name beneath it. Simon Augustino Cardinal Lord Usami wrote in Lenar Hoyt and folded the card and held it up so that it could be seen. Within a minute, all 83 of the cardinals were holding a card aloft, as were half a dozen of the interactive hollows. The scrutineer began calling the cardinals forward in order of precedence. Cardinal Lord Usami went first, leaving his stall and walking to the scrutineer's table next to the altar beneath the gaze of the terrible Christ of the fresco. Genuflecting and then kneeling at the altar, Lord Usami bowed his head in silent prayer. Rising, he said aloud,
"I call to witness Christ the Lord, who will be my judge, that my vote is given to the one who before God I consider should be elected."
Lord Usami solemnly set his folded card on the silver plate that sat atop the vote receptacle. Lifting the plate, he dropped his vote into the receptacle. The cardinal deacon among the scrutineers nodded. Lord Usami bowed toward the altar and returned to his stall. Cardinal Mustafa, the Grand Inquisitor, moved majestically toward the altar to cast the second vote. It was more than an hour later that the votes were tallied. The first scrutineer shook the receptacle to mix the votes. The second scrutineer counted them, including the six votes copied from the interactive hollows, depositing each in a second receptacle. The count equaled the number of voting cardinals in the conclave. The scrutiny proceeded. The first scrutineer unfolded a card, wrote down the name on it, and passed the card to the second scrutineer, who made a note and passed it to the third and final scrutineer. This man, Cardinal Quesnongle, as it turned out, said the name aloud before making a note of it. In each of the stalls, a cardinal jotted the name on a scriber pad provided by the scrutineers. At the end of the conclave, the scribers would be scrambled, their files deleted so that no record of the voting would remain. And so the voting proceeded. For Lord Usami, as for the rest of the living cardinals present, the only suspense was whether the dissident cardinal electors from the acclamation would actually put someone else's name into play. As each card was read, the last scrutineer ran a threaded needle through the word "Eligo" and slid the card down the thread. When all of the ballots had been read aloud, knots were tied in each end of the thread. The winning candidate was admitted to the chapel. Standing before the altar in a simple black cassock, the man looked humble and a bit overwhelmed. Standing before him, the senior deacon cardinal said,
"Do you accept your canonical election as supreme pontiff?"
"I do accept it," said the priest. At this point, a stall was brought out and set behind the priest. The cardinal deacon raised his hands and intoned,
"Thus accepting your canonical election, this gathering does, in the sight of God Almighty, acknowledge you as Bishop of the Church of Rome, true Pope, and head of the College of Bishops. May God advise you well as he grants you full and absolute power over the Church of Jesus Christ."
"Amen,"
said Cardinal Lord Usami and pulled the cord that lowered the canopy over his stall. All 83 physical canopies and 37 holographic ones lowered at the same time, until only the new popes remained raised. The priest, now pontiff, sat back in the seat beneath the papal canopy.
"What name do you choose as supreme pontiff?" asked the deacon cardinal.
"I choose the name Urban the 16th, said the seated priest. There was a murmuring and hum from the cardinal's stalls. The cardinal deacon held out his hand, and he and the other scrutineers led the priest from the chapel. The murmuring and whispering rose in volume. Cardinal Mustafa leaned out of his stall and said to Lord Usami,
"He must be thinking of Urban the 2nd. Urban the 15th was a sniveling little coward in the 29th century, who did little but read detective novels and write love letters to his former mistress." Urban II, mused Lord Asami. Yes, of course.
After several minutes, the scrutineers returned with the priest. Now the Pope dressed in pure white, a white caped Cossack, a white zucchetto or skull cap, a pectoral cross, and a white fascia sash. Cardinal Lord Asami went to his knees on the stone floor of the chapel, as did all the other cardinals, real and holographic, as the new pontiff gave his first benediction. Then the scrutineers and the attending cardinals went to the stove to burn the votes, now tethered on black thread, adding enough bianco chemical to make sure that the sfumata would indeed be white smoke. The cardinals filed out of the Sistine Chapel and walked the ancient paths and corridors to St. Peter's, where the senior cardinal deacon went alone onto the balcony to announce the name of the new pontiff to the waiting multitudes. Among the 500,000 waiting individuals in the multitude squeezed into, out of, and around St. Peter's Square that morning was Father Captain Federico de Soia. He had been released from his de facto imprisonment at the Legionaries' rectory only hours before. He was to report to Pax Fleet's spaceport later that afternoon for shuttle to his new command. Walking through the Vatican, de Soia had followed the crowds, then had been engulfed by them, as men, women, and children had flowed like a great river toward the square. A great cheer had gone up when the puffs of white smoke first became visible from the stovepipe. The impossibly thick throng beneath the balcony of St. Peter's somehow became thicker, as tens of thousands more flowed around the colonnades and past the statuary. Hundreds of Swiss Guard troopers held the crowd back from the entrance to the basilica and away from private areas. When the senior deacon emerged and announced that the new pope was to be called His Holiness Urban XVI, a great gasp went up from the crowd. De Soia found himself gaping in surprise and shock. Everyone had expected Julius XV. The thought of anyone else as pope was, well, unthinkable. Then the new pontiff stepped onto the balcony and the gasps turned to cheers that went on and on and on. It was Pope Julius, the familiar face, the high forehead, the sad eyes. Father Lennar Hoyt, the savior of the church, had once again been elected. His Holiness raised his hand in the familiar benediction and waited for the crowd to stop cheering so that he could speak, but the crowd would not stop cheering. The roar rose from 500,000 throats and went on and on. Why Urban XVI? Wondered Father Captain de Soia. He had read and studied enough history of the church in his years as a Jesuit. Quickly he thumbed back through his mental notes on the Urban popes. Most were forgettable or worse. Why? Damn. Father Captain de Soia said aloud, the soft curse lost under the continuing roar of the faithful filling St. Peter's Square. Damn, he said again. Even before the crowd quieted enough for the new old pontiff to speak, to explain his choice of names, to announce what de Soia knew had to be announced, the Father Captain understood. And his heart sank with that understanding. Urban II had served from A.D. 1088 to 1099, at the synod the Pope had called in Clermont in November in the year 1095, de Soia thought. Urban II had made his call for holy war against the Muslims in the Near East, for the rescue of Byzantium, and for the liberation of all Eastern Christian holy places from Muslim domination. That call had led to the First Crusade, the first of many bloody campaigns. The crowd finally quieted. Pope Urban XVI began to speak, the familiar but newly energized voice rising and falling over the heads of the 500,000 faithful listening in person and the billions listening via live broadcast. Father Captain de Soia turned away even before the new pope began to speak. He pushed and elbowed his way back through the unmoving crowd, trying to escape the suddenly claustrophobic confines of St. Peter's Square. It was no use. The crowd was rapt and joyous, and DeSoya was trapped in the mob. The words from the new pontiff were also joyous and impassioned. Father Captain DeSoya stood, unable to escape, and bowed his head. As the crowd began cheering and crying, "Deus le vult, God wills it," DeSoya began to weep. Crusade, glory, a final resolution of the ouster problem, death beyond imagining, destruction beyond imagining. Father Captain DeSoya squeezed his eyes shut as tightly as he could, but the vision of charged particle beams flaring against the blackness of space, of entire worlds burning, of oceans turning to steam and continents into molten rivers of lava. Visions of orbital forests exploding into smoke, of charred bodies tumbling in zero-g, of fragile, winged creatures flaring and charring and expanding into ash. DeSoya wept, while billions cheered. Chapter 4. It has been my experience that late-night departures and farewells are the hardest on the spirit. The military was especially good at beginning major voyages in the middle of the night. During my time in the Hyperion Home Guard, it seemed that all important troop movements began in the wee hours. I began to associate that odd blend of fear and excitement, dread and anticipation, with pre-dawn darkness and the smell of lateness. Ania had said that I would be leaving that night of her announcement to the Fellowship, but it took time to load the kayak, for me to pack my gear and decide what to leave behind forever, and to close up my tent and work area in the compound, so we weren't airborne in the dropship until after 2 a.m., and it was almost sunrise before we reached our destination. I admit that I felt rushed and ordered about by the girl's preemptive announcement. Many people had come to look to Ania for leadership and advice during the 4 years we spent at Taliesin West. But I wasn't one of those people. I was 32 years old. Ania was 16. It was my job to watch out for her, to protect her, and if it came to that, to tell her what to do and when to do it. I didn't like this turn of events one bit. I'd assumed that A. Betic would be flying with us to wherever I was supposed to shove off, but Ania said that the android would be staying behind at the compound. So I wasted another 20 minutes tracking him down and saying goodbye. "Emania says that we will meet up again in due course," said the blue man. "So I am confident that we shall, Emendymion." "Rawl," I said for the 500th time, "call me Rawl." "Of course," said A. Betic with that slight smile that suggested insubordination. "Fuck it," I said eloquently and stuck out my hand. A. Betic shook it. I had the urge then to hug our old traveling companion, but I knew that it would embarrass him. Androids were not literally programmed to be stiff and subservient. They were, after all, living, organic beings, not machines. But between RNA training and long practice, they were hopelessly formal creatures. At least this one was. And then we were away, Ania and I, taxiing the dropship out of its hangar into the desert night and lifting off with as little noise as possible. I had said goodbye to as many of the other Fellowship apprentices and workers as I had found, but the hour was late and the people were scattered to their dorm cubbies, tents, and apprentice shelters. I hoped that I would run into some of them again, especially some of the construction crewmen and women with whom I'd worked for 4 years, but I had little real belief that I would. The dropship could have flown itself to our destination, just a series of coordinates Ania had given it, but I left the controls on semi-manual so I could pretend I had something to do during the flight. I knew from the coordinates that we would be traveling about 1,500 clicks. Somewhere along the Mississippi River, Ania had said. The dropship could have done that distance in 10 suborbital minutes, but we had been conserving its dwindling energy and fuel resources, so once we had extended the wings to maximum, we kept our velocity subsonic, our altitude set at a comfortable 10,000 meters, and avoided morphing the ship again until landing. We ordered the consul's starship's persona,
which I'd long ago loaded from my comlog into the dropship's AI core, to keep quiet unless it had something important to tell us, and then we settled back in the red instrument glow to talk and watch the dark continent pass beneath us.
"Kiddo," I said, "why this galloping hurry?"
Ania made the self-conscious, throwing-away gesture I had first seen her use almost 5 years earlier.
"It seemed important to get things going."
Her voice was soft, almost lifeless, drained of the vitality and energy that had moved the entire fellowship to her will. Perhaps I was the only living person who could identify the tone, but she sounded close to tears.
"It can't be that important," I said, "to make me leave in the middle of the night?"
Ania shook her head and looked out the dark windscreen for a moment. I realized that she was crying. When she finally turned back, the glow from the instruments made her eyes look very moist and red.
"If you don't leave tonight, I'll lose my nerve and ask you not to go. If you don't go, I'll lose my nerve again and stay on Earth, never go back." I had the urge to take her hand then, but I kept my big paw on the Omni-controller instead.
"Hey," I said, "we can go back together. This doesn't make any sense for me to go off one way and you another."
"Yes, it does," said Ania so quietly that I had to lean to my right to hear her. "A. Bedick could go fetch the ship," I said. "You and I can stay on Earth until we're ready to return."
Ania shook her head.
"I'll never be ready to go back, Rawl. The thought scares me to death."
I thought of the wild chase that had sent us fleeing through Pax space from Hyperion, barely eluding Pax starships, torch ships, fighter aircraft, Marines, Swiss Guard, and God knows what else, including that bitch thing from hell that had almost killed us on God's Grove. And I said, "I feel the same way, kiddo. Maybe we should stay on Earth. They can't reach us here."
Ania looked at me, and I recognized the expression. It was not mere stubbornness. It was a closing of all discussion on a matter that was settled.
"All right," I said. "But I still haven't heard why A. Bedick couldn't take this kayak and go get the ship while I farcast back with you."
"Yes, you have," said Ania. "You weren't listening."
She shifted sideways in the big seat.
"Rawl, if you leave and we agree to meet at a certain time in a certain place in Pax space, I have to go through the Farcaster and do what I have to do. And what I have to do next, I have to do on my own."
"Ania," I said.
"Yes?"
"That's really stupid. Do you know that?" The 16-year-old said nothing. Below and to the left, somewhere in western Kansas, a circle of campfires became visible. I looked out at the lights amid all that darkness. "Any idea what experiment your alien friends are doing down there?" I said.
"No," said Ania. "And they aren't my alien friends."
"Which aren't they?" I said. "Aliens or friends?"
"Neither," said Ania.
I realized that this was the most specific she had ever been about the godlike intelligences that had kidnapped old Earth. And us, it seemed to me at times, as if we had been harried and driven through the Farcasters like cattle. "Care to tell me anything else about these non-alien non-friends?" I said. "After all, something could go wrong. I might not make it to our rendezvous. I'd like to know the secret of our hosts before I go." I regretted saying that as soon as the words were out. Ania pulled back as if I had slapped her.
"Sorry, kiddo," I said.
This time I did put my hand on hers. "I didn't mean that. I'm just angry." Ania nodded, and I could see the tears in her eyes again. Still mentally kicking myself, I said, "Everyone in the Fellowship was sure that the aliens were benevolent, godlike creatures. People said lions and tigers and bears, but what they were thinking was Jesus and Yahweh and E.T. from that old flat film that Mr. W. showed us. Everyone was sure that when it came time to fold up the Fellowship, the aliens would appear and lead us back to the Pax in a big mothership. No danger, no muss, no fuss."
Ania smiled, but her eyes still glistened. Humans have been waiting for Jesus and Yahweh and E.T. to save their asses since before they covered those asses with bearskins and came out of the cave, she said. They'll have to keep waiting. This is our business, our fight, and we have to take care of it ourselves.
Ourselves being you and me and Abedic against 800 billion or so of the born-again faithful, I said softly.
Ania made the graceful gesture with her hand again. Yeah, she said. For now.
When we arrived, it was not only still dark, but raining hard. A cold, sleety end-of-autumn rain. The Mississippi was a big river, one of old Earth's largest, and the dropship circled over it once before landing in a small town on the west bank. I saw all of this on the view screen under image enhancement. The view out the actual windscreen was blackness and rain. We came in over a high hill covered with bare trees, crossed an empty highway that spanned the Mississippi on a narrow bridge, and landed in an open, paved area about 50 meters from the river. The town ran back from the river here in a valley between wooded hills, and on the view screen, I could make out small wooden buildings, larger brick warehouses, and a few taller structures near the river that might have been grain silos. Those kind of structures had been common in the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries in this part of old Earth. I had no idea why this city had been spared the earthquakes and fires of the tribulations, or why the lions and tigers and bears had rebuilt it, if they had. There had been no sign of people in the narrow streets, nor of heat signatures on the infrared bands. Neither living creatures nor ground cars with their overheated internal combustion drive systems. But then again, it was almost 4:30 in the morning, on a cold, rainy night. No one with an ounce of sense would be out in that lousy, stinking weather. We both pulled on ponchos. I hefted my small backpack and said, "So long, ship. Don't do anything I wouldn't do." And we were down the morphed stairs and into the rain. Ania helped me tug the kayak out of the storage area in the belly of the dropship, and we headed down the slick street toward the river. On our previous river adventure, I had carried night vision goggles, an assortment of weapons, and a raft full of fancy gadgets. This night, I had the flashlight laser that was our only memento of the trip out to Earth, set to its weakest, most energy-conserving setting. It illuminated about 2 meters of rain-slick street. A Navajo hunting knife in my backpack and some sandwiches and dried fruit packed away. I was ready to take on the packs. "What is this place?" I said.
"Hannibal," said Ania,
struggling to hold the slick kayak as we stumbled down the street. By this point, I had to shift the slim flashlight laser in my teeth, keeping both hands on the bow of the stupid little boat. When we reached the point where the street became a loading ramp, running into the black torrent of the Mississippi, I set the kayak down, removed the flashlight, and said, "St. Petersburg." I had spent hundreds and hundreds of hours reading in the Fellowship compound's rich library of print books. I saw Ania's hooded figure nod in the reflected glow of the flashlight beam. "This is crazy," I said, swinging the flashlight beam around the empty street, against the wall of the brick warehouses, out to the dark river. The rush of dark water was frightening. Any thought of setting off on that was insane.
"Yes," said Ania. "Crazy."
The cold rain beat on the hood of her poncho. I went around the kayak and took her by the arm.